Well, my name is Richard Packham, and I'm going to be talking today on Joseph Smith's language problems, subtitled A Linguist Looks at Mormonism. Mormonism has been examined by scientists and scholars on numerous bases, biological, historical, cosmological, etc. But so far as I'm aware, there has not been a total look at all of Mormonism from a linguist's point of view. My interest in language and foreign languages and linguistics goes back for quite a while. When I was in high school, I took Spanish and Latin, which was the only languages they offered. I went on to BYU and took German, continued with my Spanish, I learned French, and had the idea of becoming a language teacher. I studied German linguistics as a master's degree candidate, and began to teach Latin, German, and Spanish Latin, German, and English in Ogden at a high school. During that time, I also studied Russian, and then I had an opportunity to work towards a doctorate degree at Johns Hopkins, where I studied Anglo-Saxon, Old Icelandic, Gothic, Sanskrit, Classical Greek, Old and Middle High German, as well as studying comparative and historic linguistic methodology. In the years since, I've also studied Mandarin Chinese, Esperanto, Hebrew, and acquired a reading knowledge of Dutch and Italian. And during my 35 years as a foreign language teacher, I found that the knowledge and experience of comparative and historical linguistics helped me with my teaching and also gave me a different kind of perspective on Mormonism, and that's what I'd like to share with you today. Joseph Smith, Jr., the founder of Mormonism, was also fascinated with language from the very beginning of his career. He was raised in a culture which believed in folk magic and the powers of language and mystical words. And of course, that's held over into the present-day church that he founded, where the exact words have to be used when you're being baptized or when the sacrament is being blessed. And if the words are not exactly right, the magic doesn't work. His first major venture into religious matters was a purported translation of Golden Plates delivered to him by an angel and written in a hitherto unknown language called Reformed Egyptian, which he claimed to be able to translate through the power of God. When he later organized a church, he included among the titles of the and powers of the head of the church that of translator. It was also important in the Articles of Faith that where he's a translator, and that the Book of Mormon was translated by the power of God. Also, one of the gifts of that is to be a part of the church is the gift of tongues. He was very proud of his foreign language ability, Joseph Smith was, when he dashed off an appeal to the freemen of the state of Vermont. He demonstrated his linguistic skill by writing in 17 different languages. In addition to the Book of Mormon, he did some other translating. The Book of Abraham, and with accompanying which he wrote an Egyptian alphabet and grammar. the inspired version of the Bible, which he said was a translation, but it really wasn't a translation. It was just a revision. And as we learned earlier this afternoon, it was mostly done not by Joseph Smith, but by Sidney Rigdon. He also translated the Kinderhook plates, which was a group of six metal plates with strange engraved characters unearthed in 1843 near Kinderhook, Illinois, and examined by Smith. They took him to Smith because they had heard that this Mormon prophet was able to translate strange foreign languages. And he never completed a translation of them, but he did translate enough so that he was able to identify them as an ancient record and identify the author as a descendant of Ham through the loins of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Local farmers later revealed that they had themselves manufactured and engraved and buried the plates as a hoax. This is covered in the history of the church, interestingly enough, and in the edition I have, which is around 1930, with edited by B.H. Roberts, B.H. Roberts goes to pains to defend the genuineness of the Kinderhook plates. So you can look that up. He also translated a parchment that had been written by the Apostle John, the John the Beloved, and hidden up by him. It appears in Doctrine and Covenants, section 7. Smith did not actually have possession, physical possession of the parchment, but was still able to translate it. Mormon scholar Hugh Nibley cites this feat as proof of Smith's power to translate, because a prophet of God doesn't really have to have the actual original in front of him in order to translate. Now, although the translation was published in the Book of Commandments in 1833, in which book there was a revelation from God saying that everything in that book was true, nevertheless, when it was republished in the Doctrine and Covenants in 1835, major changes had been made to the translation, which God had said was correct. Oh, that slide you need to see, because although the power of a translator is part of the office of the president of the church, down to this present day, no other president of the church has dared or attempted to translate anything, even though there are things there to be translated, such as the papyrus containing what Joseph identified was the Book of Joseph. Now, I don't know that anyone has asked anybody among the church leadership as to why the Book of Joseph has not been translated by one of the prophets who has the divine skill to do so. But I can tell you what their answer would be, and that would be, we have not been instructed by God to do that, because the world is not yet ready for that information. Okay. Now, when you ask about this whole idea of being translated by the power of God, that implies a number of things, it seems to me. That God wants to give us a message, that he wants the message to be accurate, and that God knows how we will interpret the message. And we have to assume that God does know all human languages. I mean, God himself would not have to need an interpreter if somebody from some strange African tribe were praying to him, and God would have to call in his Bantu something interpreter to understand it. I mean, God understands all languages. The Book of Mormon has a warning that has sometimes been used by people, by a Mormon apologist objecting to what we criticize about the translations, where Mormon writes, if there be faults in this record, they be the faults of a man. And I confronted one of the apologists who made this objection when I raised some questions about how the translation problems in the Book of Mormon. And he cited me this verse. And I pointed out to him, this is Mormon writing about the words that he is putting down on the plates. It does not apply to the translation that was made by divine power. No, I never heard from him back. Well, one thing I think we need to remember in any kind of discussion about Mormonism is this crucial passage from the Doctrine and Covenants. It is not the work of God that is frustrated, but the work of man. So if you find some problem with something that claims to be the work of God, then it's not the work of God. Here are some of the examples where the Mormon apologists have actually done so. They have denied that. They have said these are incorrect translations. And you're familiar with all of these. The horse is not a horse. A horse, in spite of the popular song, a horse is a horse, of course. The chariot is a sledge or some kind of thing that the Indians dragged behind them. North is really west, if you are a limited geography proponent, because it doesn't work if with the sea land northward and the land southward. According to that theory, it's the land westward and the land southward. That plates of gold were not really gold. They were some metal called tumbaga, which is a copper alloy. And that steel swords are really wooden mahuacals, which was a weapon used by the Mesoamerican natives. And that the narrow neck of land is really not a narrow neck. It's 160 miles wide at the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. And remember that if that is true, the people who described that piece of narrow neck came from a country that was only about 100 miles long. Well, let's move on. There are a lot of documents in the history of the world, both religious and non-religious and secular, that claim to be by somebody, but they're not really by that person. They're called pseudepigraphs. They are purporting to be by somebody, often somebody very, very ancient, in order to give it some kind of authority. The Donation of Constantine, for example, is a well-known historical example of such a pseudepigraph. Or the Songs of Ossian. You any familiar with the Songs of Ossian? It was a guy who, in England, who made up a bunch of ancient Celtic poems from a legendary poet, Ossian, and he published them, and they were very, very popular in the early 19th century, and people took them to be genuine, and it turned out he'd just made them up. Well, let's go on. The last part of Isaiah, for example, is a pseudepigraph. According to most biblical scholars, the first part of Isaiah is written by the prophet named Isaiah, so far as we can tell. But the last part, obviously, is not. So it's somebody else writing at a later time, and that's how we recognize it, is because of the anachronisms, and I'll talk about that in a moment. The Book of Daniel is especially interesting to Mormons, I think, because it's what I call the Bible's Book of Mormon. It has so much in common, the Book of Daniel, with the Book of Mormon. It was sealed up. Are you familiar with the Book of Daniel in the Old Testament? Okay. It was sealed up to be brought forth in the last days, just like the Book of Mormon. It contained prophecies of the future. And of course, what it said was, by saying this book will come forth, will be sealed up until it comes forth in the last days, and I'm talking about the Book of Daniel now, would mean that when the book came forth, that was the last days. Do you know when the Book of Daniel came forth? About 165 B.C. So it wasn't the last days. Also, the book of Daniel contained numerous linguistic and historical anachronisms and downright errors. Does that sound like the Book of Mormon? Okay. So that's why I call the book of Daniel the Old Testament's Book of Mormon. And the epistles of Peter, the 1st and 2nd Peter, those are obviously pseudepigraphs. Apostle Peter was long dead when those epistles appeared, and they are not in the style of Greek that a poor Aramaic fisherman would have been writing. And some of the epistles of Paul are also pseudepigraphs. The way we identify pseudepigraphs is often by recognizing anachronisms. And I'll illustrate what anachronism is. This is a typed copy from a written document, book, that unfortunately no longer exists, but we have the typed copy, the Journal of General George Washington. And it's something that I found among my grandfather's papers, and it's fascinating because nobody has ever seen it before, but it has interesting information. It talks about things that we know are correct about the life of George Washington. It tells some things that we didn't know, but they seem to make sense. But then we come across this passage. This afternoon received an urgent wire, took the railroad train to Philadelphia, arrived toward evening, met by Mr. Adams at the station. Well, now, what strikes you right there? You know, there were no railroad trains in Washington's time. There was no wire. There's no station, you know. Now, if you were a member of the apologists who were defending this document, and they said, well, maybe wire was a word that was George Washington used to mean a message, you know? It wasn't what we think of a wire. It's what, but the problem with that is nobody else was using the word wire in that sense. We find no other examples of the use of that word in that meaning. And the same for railroad train, and the same for station. Those are anachronisms of things. Those things did not exist. There are also linguistic anachronisms. For example, we also find later on a passage, Colonel Wright suspects a British Fifth Column working in the Carolinas. Now, what strikes you out about that? If you know anything about the history of various languages and vocabulary, and you look up the term Fifth Column, it's a term that was invented during the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s. And so there's no way that George Washington could have been using that. Now, suppose I were to tell you, well, this is only 2-3 little anachronisms. Does that really matter? I mean, look, 99% of it is okay. Well, I hope you would say, no, it looks to me like a fraud. But here's the clincher. Suppose an angel appeared to me and told me that this was authentic George Washington. Would the angel story make a difference? I would hope not. No. Okay. A general topic I'd like to, before we get into some specifics, is the use of the King James English in the Book of Mormon. And that was talked about a little bit by previous. Not too many people are that familiar with King James English in order to be fluent in it. The English, we refer to it as King James English. It's also sometimes called Elizabethan English or Shakespearean English. It was the language of the day. It was a well-established language, and like any well-established language of a fairly civilized country, it had its grammatical rules. And these were not arbitrary rules. They were not laid down by any lawgiver, but they were the rules that arose by sort of automatically among the speakers. Because if you don't have grammatical rules, you have more difficulty communicating. And there were rules in King James English. For example, in King James English, there were both a singular and a plural form for the words that meant the person or persons you were speaking to. And the forms differed as to whether the word was being used as the subject of a verb or as the object of a verb or a preposition. And in the singular, the words were thou, and it always had the verb ending, well, almost, and almost all verbs, there are a few exceptions, almost always had the ending st, like thou goest, thou seest, thou knowest. The object form of that word was thee. The plurals were ye if it was the subject of a verb, like ye are the children of God, ye know that this is the truth. But if it was the object, then it was you. Now, these were not interchangeable, just as no English speaker who speaks at all correct English would interchange they and them. You cannot interchange ye and you any more than you can interchange they and them. For example, if I were to say, them are not good people, you'd say, that's, where did you go to school? nor would you use the plural forms for a singular person. If you're talking to just one person, you use the singular form. The only exception to that was if you were speaking to someone to whom you owed tremendous respect, like royalty. This is the, or started with the royal we, you know, the in English, when the royal personage, when the queen speaks, she doesn't say, I am displeased. She would say, we are displeased. It's the royal we, all right? And that took over also with the words for you. So you could use the plural form addressing a singular person if it was a person of great prominence. If you look at King James English in the Bible, as it's used in the Bible, the word has never occurs, because that was not King James English. The word, correct word, was hath, you know, God hath done this. If any school kid in Elizabethan times had come in and say, my brother has a dog, the teacher would say, why sayest thou he has? That is wrong. Thou shouldst say he hath a dog. And he'd get probably a few lashes. In the Mormon scriptures, however, the Book of Mormon has 237 occurrences of has, and the Doctrine and Covenants has 134. And it's the same with, whereas the hath occurs sometimes in the Book of Mormon, and sometimes it does not. We're going to talk about that. Okay. Same thing with does and doth. I'll skip on with that. Now here's King James English in the Doctrine and Covenants. And remember, the Doctrine and Covenants is not claimed to be an ancient scripture. One could say, well, you know, the Book of Mormon was an ancient scripture, and it was customary in the 19th century to translate ancient writings in a sort of an archaic style. You know, if you wanted to translate the plays of Euripides or something like that into the English of the 19th century, you wouldn't translate it into 19th century English. You'd translate it into the archaic form, which was Elizabethan or King James English. And that's fine. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But you should at least translate it into grammatically correct archaic form. But with the Doctrine and Covenants, they don't have that excuse because the Doctrine and Covenants is not intended to be an ancient scripture. Not only that, it's grammatically incorrect. Now, I'm going to show you just a few examples of the lousy, grammatically incorrect King James English in the Doctrine and Covenants. And you have to ask, first of all, why is the Doctrine and Covenants appearing in King James English? And they are the words of God, and God is making all kinds of dumb schoolboy mistakes in the grammar. For example, this one, you know, is an example of how he switches from the singular to the plural. He says, which I gave you, and thou art still chosen. Well, that kind of change is grammatically impossible. Whoever said that or wrote that had no notion of the difference between singular and plural in King James English. And there are a couple of others here that are similar kinds of errors. Here's more examples. There's this one passage. For 14 verses, 28 occurrences of you and your should be singular. He is speaking to Joseph. God is speaking to Joseph Smith. Then finally, verse 15, he gets it correct and uses thy God to get the to tempt thy God. And then switches back in the next verse. I say unto thee, put your trust in the, you know, all grammatically incorrect. Here's some more mistakes, incorrect use of ye and you. Why does Joseph Smith do that, or whoever wrote these passages in the Doctrine and Covenants? One can't escape thinking that Joseph Smith thought that God spoke King James English badly. Of course, Joseph Smith obviously didn't realize the badly part, but he obviously thought that God spoke King James English. And that idea still is alive today in the Mormon Church, because, you know, when you pray to God, you are supposed to say thee and thou when you address God, and thy. You know, we ask thy blessing upon us. And if you ask any of church leaders why, actually there was, and I forget which apostle it was that explained why, and that is because thou and thee and thy show more respect, and which is exactly backwards, because the singular forms were the ones you used when you didn't have to necessarily show respect. You used the plural forms when you wanted to show respect, and that is still true in languages that have this distinction today, like German and Spanish and French. Well, let's go on now to talk about some specific language problems. What about this word Mormon? If you look up in a Greek dictionary, ancient Greek dictionary, you'll find the word Mormon. Mormo or Mormon is the stem, and it means scarecrow or bugbear or ghost or demon. And somebody in Joseph Smith's time apparently found this and thought he'd make us a little hay out of it. And so Joseph Smith responded. And this is what he wrote. he said, in one of his publications, he explained that there was no Latin or Greek in the plates. Remember that for later, okay? Joseph Smith says there was no Latin or Greek in the plates. And then he goes on to explain that the word Mormon is from the Egyptian word mun, meaning good, and the prefix more. And so it means more good. Now you have to ask yourself, how could this word have a more have an English element in it? What is ironic is, have you heard of the More Good Foundation that the Mormon some Mormons have set up? Okay. There are characteristics of Hebrew names and characteristics of Greek names. And we're going to see in a moment that Joseph Smith obviously didn't know the difference. On the left are common Hebrew names. You'll notice that some of them end in A-H, Jonah. Of course, the J represents the Y sound in Hebrew. So it would be pronounced Yohanan, Yonah, Judah, Yeshua, Isaiah, Eliyah. Some of those names have forms also in Greek, and some of them appear in the New Testament because the New Testament is written in Greek. And they appear there as Johannes, Jonas, Judas, or Judea. Judea was the name of the country. Jesus does not appear in the New Testament, but that's the Aramaic form. The Greek form of the Hebrew name Yeshua. And then the Greek form of Isaiah is Esaias, and the Greek form of Elijah is Elias. Now, the names Elijah and Isaiah both appear in the King James Bible. Isaiah, being the Hebrew version, appears in the Old Testament. In the Greek New Testament, the Greek translator or the Greek writers used the Greek form of the name Isaias, and of course the King James translators, relying on the Greek text, they kept the Greek version of the name in the King James Bible. And so in the King James translation you have Isaiah in the Old Testament and Isaias in the New Testament. They are the same prophet, the same person. Joseph Smith didn't know that. And apparently God didn't tell him either. Because in the Doctrine and Covenants, Isaiah and Isaias appear as separate prophets in several places, such as in this passage from the Doctrine and Covenants 76, some of Isaias and some of Isaiah. It's also in the Book of Mormon. And behold, also Zenok, and also Isaias, and also Isaiah. In the LDS Bible Dictionary, it explains the two names, and it explains that Isaias is the New Testament Greek form of the name Isaiah, and also, it's an ancient prophet who lived in the days of Abraham and who was blessed by him. He was a bearer of the Melchizedek priesthood, as recorded in Doctrine and Covenants, section 84. Doctrine and Covenants 84 says, "And Isaias received the holy priesthood under the hand of God, and Isaias also lived in the days of Abraham and was blessed of him." I won't show you that slide yet, okay? So, according to modern revelation through Joseph Smith, there was a prophet in the days of Abraham who had a Greek name several centuries before the Greek language had developed. The same name as used later by speakers of Greek 2,000 years later for the great prophet Isaiah, and who appears to be unknown by any other biblical writer, but upon whom God personally conferred the priesthood. And his prophecies of the coming Savior are lost. Perhaps God should have explained to him that really They are just two different names for the same person, just as the king who is called Charlemagne by the French and Charlemagne by the English is the same person that the Germans call Karl der Große. And I have to remember my ex-Mormon wife's mother, my former mother-in-law, who pulled the same trick or was under the same problem. We were talking one time about politics and somehow Theodore Roosevelt came up. And she said, oh, Theodore Roosevelt, he was a wonderful man. And she said, but that Teddy Roosevelt. The same problem exists with Elijah and Elias, because one name is Hebrew and the other is the Greek version of the very same name. It becomes important because the prophet Elijah is important because he appears in the prophecy towards almost the end of the Old Testament in Malachi chapter 4. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. We'll be talking about this in a moment. Now, the fame of Elijah, of course, rested not only on his great life and the Malachi prophecy, but on the fact that he did not die. He was carried into heaven without tasting death. It was perhaps this fact that allowed Jews to accept the possibility that Elijah would someday return. The name of Elijah does not occur in that form in the Greek New Testament, nor does Elias occur in the Old Testament. Elias occurs 30 times in the New Testament. But it is every time Elias is mentioned in the New Testament, it's a reference to the prophet Elijah in the Old Testament or to the prophecy of Malachi that mentions. Most modern translations of the Bible don't allow for this confusion. Most modern translators translate the New Testament using the Old Testament name Elijah, and same with Isaiah. But Joseph Smith didn't know that. And in the Kirtland Temple, miracle of miracles, both Elias and Elijah occur, as reported in the Doctrine and Covenants 1:10. This has caused no end of trouble for Mormon theologians. Bruce R. McConkie tried to deal with this problem. In his book, Mormon Doctrine, it takes more than 3 pages for him to try to unravel the problems. According to Bruce R. McConkie, the Elias means several different things. Prophet of Abraham's time, as reported in the Doctrine and Covenants. It's the Greek form of Elijah. At least McConkie was smart enough to know that. It's also the spirit and doctrine of Elias, and he gets this from sermons of Joseph Smith. And then there were also people who held the title of Elias because they were precursors. For example, Christ was an Elias, according to McConkie. The angel Gabriel was an Elias, and of course Gabriel is also Noah. And John the Revelator was an Elias, and also John the Baptist was an Elias. Now, which explanation makes more sense and is more likely? McConkie's, who says Elias is a hitherto unknown prophet of Abraham's time with a Greek name, or maybe Abraham himself, or Melchizedek, and Christ, and Elijah, and John the Baptist, and John the Revelator, and a spirit or doctrine. Or the more obvious conclusion that Joseph Smith was simply ignorant of the fact that the King James New Testament uses the Greek version of Old Testament names. And the moral to this story, I think, is all it takes is one stupid mistake to form the basis for an entire complicated theology and provide for 3 pages of explanation from a Mormon apologist. Let's talk now about the names Elohim and Jehovah or Yahweh. The four-letter combination, which I'm reproducing here in English from Hebrew, the Hebrew characters, YHWH, is never written with the vowels and is usually not even written by pious Jews. And scholars have surmised that it was probably pronounced Yahweh. And it has been transliterated into the English version Jehovah, which is a bastardized name, really. Elohim in the Bible, in the Old Testament, was the word that means God. It's just the vocabulary word that means God, just like Deus in Latin or Gott in German. Whereas Yahweh is translated in the King James Version as the Lord. I'm sorry, I've kind of misstated that. I emphasized the wrong thing. Elohim in the King James translation, the term Elohim, when it appeared in Hebrew, in the Hebrew version, is translated by the King James translators as God. The term Yahweh is translated by the phrase the Lord. So you can look at your King James Bible and you can tell what the original word was in Hebrew by whether it's God, which means it was Elohim in the Hebrew, or the Lord, which means it was Jehovah. There's a passage in Exodus that, and this is my translation literally from Hebrew, and Elohim spoke to Moses and said to him, I am Yahweh. And I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai, God Almighty. But by my name Yahweh, I was not known to them. Okay? So Elohim and Yahweh are the Jewish God. Hebrew scriptures have also the forms El, which we saw on the last slide, El Shaddai. Eloi or Elohim. Elohim is in form a plural, according to Hebrew grammar. And Jehovah is the name of God. All right? Now, in Mormon doctrine, however, Elohim is the name of God the Father, and Jehovah is the name of God the Son, Jesus Christ. That's a statement of the First Presidency. Thus, once again, Smith assumes that two different names must signify two different personages. And we'll say a little bit more about that. Let's talk now about the terms Christ and Messiah. The Hebrew word Mashiach literally means the anointed one. It's from the verb that means to anoint. And it was not used specifically in a theological sense. It was used to refer to any person who, according to Hebrew custom, was anointed. That could be kings, it could be prophets, or anybody else that was to be anointed. The Greek term, which meant anointed, was Christos. And that's from the Greek word that means to anoint. And when the Greeks were When the New Testament writers, writing in Greek, came across the Hebrew term Mashiach, they translated it as Christos, which means the same thing, the anointed one. In Hebrew or Aramaic, by the way, and if you're not aware, Aramaic was the sort of language of the common people that developed about 200 BC, and it was derived from Hebrew, but had similarities to Hebrew, but it's about the same kind of difference between King James English and modern English. So if the term or the name Yeshua HaMashiach, which would mean Jesus the Anointed, were to appear in Greek, it would come out as Jesus Ho Christos. Now, one of the fundamental teachings of Christianity, and of course I'm including Mormonism in this, since Mormons share this view, is that Jesus was that promised Messiah or anointed king. Now, in Greek, in the Greek of the New Testament, he was referred to Jesus Christos. In Hebrew, that would be Yeshua LaMashiach. I guess I skipped a slide or didn't have a slide here. It's coming up, yeah. Several questions arise now when we find the term in the Book of Mormon, which was translated from Hebrew written in Reformed Egyptian, or something like that. We find that the term Messiah occurs 25 times in the Book of Mormon, and the term Christ appears 317 times. And there's a very interesting passage where both terms appear in the same passage, and that's the one on the screen. The Messiah cometh in 600 years, etc., 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 according to the words of the prophets, and according to the word of the angel of God, his name shall be Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Now, linguistically, that has a couple of problems. Putting aside the question, of course, what Old Testament prophets said that the Messiah would be named Jesus Christ? We have to ask what this text must have looked like in Reformed Egyptian, since it's translating two occurrences of the same word, one in the Hebrew form and one in the Greek form. Why? I mean, let's make up the Hebrew word or Hebrew word and written in Egyptian, let's say it was corn chip. And that word occurs in the gold plates that are being translated. And that passage would then read, according to the words of the prophet, the words of the angel of God, the corn chip shall be named Jesus Corn Chip. why are they using two different terms? More on Greek now in the Book of Mormon. I had that one already. In the Book of Mormon, in this passage, 1 Nephi, Nephi has just beheaded Laban and has disguised himself in Laban's miraculously non-bloody clothing. And he is speaking to Laban's servant. And he says, I spake unto him that I should carry the engravings which were upon the plates to my plates of brass to my elder brethren who were without the walls. And I bade him that he should follow me. And he, supposing that I spoke of the brethren of the church, and that I was truly that Laban, wherefore he did follow me. Now, remember, this is a Jew in Jerusalem in 600 B.C., and remember, too, that this translation is supposed to be divinely inspired. What word in Reformed Egyptian that God would inspire Joseph Smith to translate as church? The word church is never used in the Old Testament, King James Version. Not even, in fact, there was no such thing as a church among the Jews in 600 B.C., when the Jews referred to the religious community of the Jews, which was really just the community of the Jews, including their government and their religion and their customs, there was no notion of religion or religious organization apart from the idea of the community. They used Hebrew terms, which are translated in the King James Version Old Testament as the congregation, which occurs over 300 times. And There are several words that are translated that like that. Hebrew moed, meeting place, or edah, meaning assembly or meeting place, or kahal, meaning a gathering. Why would God not inspire Joseph Smith to use a word that would fit in with the King James style that Smith was using already, like congregation? The word church occurs in the Bible, in the King James Version, only in the New Testament, and only, except for two passages in Matthew, which most scholars feel are a later interpolation, it occurs only after the death of Jesus and the rise of that organization which came to be called the church, and which is usually used to translate the Greek word ecclesia, from which we get our word ecclesiastic, which means assembly, and it was to call forth. And in the New Testament, it was used to distinguish those followers of Jesus from the rest of the Jewish community. So the Jewish community was the community, Jewish community, and what was called forth, the Christians, came to be called the church. Becomes even stranger when Nephi begins to talk about the two churches of God and the devil in 14th chapter of 1 Nephi, in the sense of distinctive religious groups with differing beliefs. There was no such concept. I mean, in 600 BC. And then in Mosiah, long after Nephi, Mosiah chapter 25, I've got that on the screen. The word churches is used as though it's being used for the first time in these gold plates. The author feels he must explain what these churches are. The word church means. But didn't Nephi already use the term that means church? And didn't the writer of Mosiah have Nephi's writing available? Well, of course, we learned the secret, the explanation for that earlier this afternoon, that Mosiah was written before Nephi. Synagogue is a problem. The Jews in Palestine were meeting in synagogues for worship, prayer, and teaching. And synagogues are mentioned frequently in the Book of Mormon, 25 occurrences. However, the word as used there is not used as a variant of church, but rather appears to be something different, usually the place of worship of a sincere but false religion. And one of the occurrences is here in Alma 16. And Alma went forth, Alma and Amulek went forth preaching in the synagogues, which were built after the manner of the Jews. Now, this is interesting, because the Book of Mormon does not indicate that there was any connection, any kind of communication between the people of Lehi and the Nephites and the Jews back in Jerusalem after they left in 595 or whatever it was. Scholars of Jewish religion, however, are unanimous in the view that the synagogue, which we think of as so typical of Jewish religious life, did not exist among the Jews before the destruction of the temple and the Babylonian captivity. They only arose because there was no temple anymore, and the Jews needed a place to get together and preserve their religion. So how could any Nephite know about synagogues after the manner of the Jews? And of course, the word synagogue itself is Greek from sin, meaning together, and ag, meaning to bring. And let me emphasize, too, that Greek influence in Palestine was almost entirely unknown in 600 BC. It was only after the conquest by Alexander the Great, about 300 BC, that Greek was even introduced into Palestine when the country was Hellenized by Alexander. Here's another problem, and that's the word Bible. In 2 Nephi, Nephi, who is supposedly writing about 550 B.C., prophesies that when the book he is writing comes forth, many of the Gentiles shall say, "A Bible, a Bible. We have got a Bible." Now, the Bible in the Book of Mormon here is being used in the sense that the term had in the 19th century America. That is a collection of sacred writings in a closed canon. The word Bible, of course, is not found in the Bible itself. When the original Bible writers wanted to refer to sacred writings, the Hebrew writers in the Old Testament used the Hebrew word katav, meaning writings, and it was used for any kind of writings. The New Testament writers in Greek used the word graphē, which also meant simply something written, and it could also mean something drawn. There was no canon at that time. Our English word Bible is an anglicization of the Greek word biblia, which means books, and is simply the plural of the Greek word biblion, which means a book. This word in its singular form appears only about 20 times in the New Testament and refers to a particular sacred book. It never appears in the plural except once, and then it refers to pagan writings. The idea of a Christian canon, that is, a list of approved books, a Bible in our traditional sense, began only in the 2nd century A.D., and the first such canon was put together by Marcion about 150 A.D., and who is now considered by Christians to be a heretic. At the time Lehi supposedly left Jerusalem, the idea of a closed canon of Scripture had not yet developed. There was no such thing. If you study the history of the development of the Jewish and Christian canon, you'll find that the idea of canonizing sacred books, that is, putting a stamp of approval on it with divine authority, did not arise until the time of the Alexandrian Jews, the 3rd century B.C. in Alexandria. They had come under such Greek influence that they weren't fluent in Hebrew anymore, and they needed to have their sacred scriptures translated into Greek. And this was about 250 B.C. Thus, the decision had to be made for among these people about which books should be translated into Greek for us Greek-speaking Hebrews, or Greek-speaking Jews. And so they started off with the law and then continued with the prophets. And the result was, of course, the Greek Septuagint version of the Old Testament. So the question arises then, with the word Bible in 2 Nephi, what Hebrew or Reformed Egyptian word appeared on the golden plates to be translated as Bible? If the Book of Mormon were authentic and historically accurate, one would expect that when God told Nephi that the Gentiles would cry, a Bible, we have got a Bible," Nephi would have asked, "Oh, excuse me, wait a minute, God, what does Bible mean? It's an idea I'm not familiar with." And God would have given him an explanation so that Nephite readers of his record, if there were any, would know what was meant. Let's look at more Greek names in the Book of Mormon. Remember, Joseph Smith specifically said there was no Greek or Latin in the Book of Mormon. Here are a list of some names that are Greek in form. Any Greek speaker would recognize these as Greek names. And, you know, you can look in the back of your Book of Mormon where it has the list of proper names, and you can find all of these. They are all Greek. Alpha and Omega, of course. That one may be... it's the name of the first and last letters of the Greek alphabet, of course. I am Alpha and Omega. Well, one Mormon apologist would say, you know, Joseph Smith was familiar with this term, and his readers would be familiar with this term. And so probably the real words there were not Alpha and Omega, but Aleph and Tau, which were the first and last letters of the Hebrew alphabet. We have the phenomenon that in the Book of Mormon, there are a number of names or words which the author, the writer on the gold plates, translates for us. And here they are with their translations. Now, there are several questions arise in my skeptical mind. If these were real Reformed Egyptian or Nephite words with those meanings, why would Nephi be translating them for us? It would be like my writing something like, and which I knew was going to be translated later on, and they came unto Salt Lake, which being interpreted means Salt Lake. Irriantum is particularly problematical because Nephi says that this is a name given by the Lehites to the Indian Ocean. We must assume that the Lehite band were still speaking relatively pure Hebrew since they'd only left Jerusalem a few years before, but Irriantum is not a Hebrew word. It doesn't even resemble a Hebrew word. There are a few words that are not translated. They are strange words. Apparently these are Reformed Egyptian words, but they are not translated. Now, why not? One wonders why these weren't saying Neos, which being interpreted means da-da-da-da-da, and name some common vegetable. Neos and Shum are some kind of edible plant, which was very popular, apparently. And the Kurilams and Kumams were very useful animals. And Ziph was a kind of metal. And these items were apparently very abundant. And yet, God's translator was unable to identify them with any word that his 19th century readers or later would be able to understand. I mean, was a Kurilam some kind of strange beast that archaeologists know or that was known among the Aztecs as something else, like maybe a tapir or something? Why weren't they translated? So you have to wonder about that. One suspects that it was just Joseph Smith showing off his ability to make up strange words to impress his readers. Well, that's the skeptic's explanation. Then we have the opposite here. These are words that are translated, obviously, but there's no original given. They're English words, obviously. Now, I'm sure that the Nephite towns and countries that were called this were not really named Bountiful with the English name. I mean, that wouldn't make sense at all. But what was the Nephite or Reformed Egyptian word? Why isn't that there? It's just an unanswerable question. And then if he was inspired to translate these, why didn't he simply translate the others, the Irriantum and the Ripliancum? Well, there are questions that we just don't have answers for yet. Let's talk about a few more specific ones. We're getting towards the end here. One of the problems with the Book of Mormon is that it carries over some of the King James translators' errors. Almost all Bible scholars of whatever persuasion, Christian, non-Christian, whatever, recognize that the King James Version, the translation, it's a beautiful piece of literature and has many wonderful passages, but there are a lot of errors. There are mistakes, outright mistakes. And we find those same mistakes in the Book of Mormon. For example, in Isaiah and in Nephi is the passage from that Christians often refer to as a prophecy of the birth of Christ. A virgin shall conceive and bear us a son, and his name shall be called Emmanuel. The problem is, by the way, this passage is also referred to by in the Gospel of Mark, Gospel of Matthew. He cites this passage as evidence for the prophetic birth of Christ. In the Hebrew, in Isaiah, Hebrew has two different words for slightly different concepts. The word Alma means a young woman, whether she's a virgin or not. She's just a young woman. Whereas if you want to talk about somebody who's a virgin, you use the term Bethula. And in Isaiah uses the term Alma. He does not use the term Bethula. And modern translators of the Old Testament, who are not bound by their Christian theology, translate it that way nowadays. They say, a young woman shall conceive. And of course, if you read it in context, it turns out that in the next few passages, there is the birth of a child by a young woman, and it foretells the outcome of this war. The problem is that in the Septuagint, when the Septuagint was translated, Greek has only one word for both a young woman and a virgin, and that word is parthenos. The King James translators, in order to make their work a little bit easier, I suspect, relied extensively on the Septuagint to translate King James version, and so they were misled by the Greek parthenos, and by Matthew's passage, where he refers to this passage, to translate it virgin. And lo and behold, it also occurs in the Book of Mormon. Didn't have to go through Greek, but, you know, it never occurred to me. Maybe Nephi had the Septuagint. Do you suppose? Lucifer, this is one of my favorites. Lucifer appears only once in the King James translation of the Bible, and that's in Isaiah, the passage that I have up here. Isaiah, O Lucifer, son of the morning. The word is there. The Hebrew text has Hillel, which means the morning star or to shine, and it also represents the star of Venus. It's a word that is very similar to the Hebrew word halal, which means to boast. And that makes sense in Isaiah. He's saying, this is a passage is addressed to the king of Babylon, and he's saying, oh boy, you're such a boaster. You halal around. You're such a hellel, your bright morning star. You're going to be falling. You're fallen. And that makes sense. It's a pun. The Greek word for that is heosphoros or phosphoros, light bearer. And in Latin, the word to translate phosphoros is Lucifer, meaning light bearer. And so the idea that Lucifer was the name of the devil did not arise until about the 3rd century A.D. And so we've got error upon error. A Latin word in the Hebrew or Reformed Egyptian Book of Mormon. And we have to ask then, what is the Hebrew or Reformed Egyptian word that this was translating, and how did it come to mean Lucifer? Well, we're getting close to the time. I'm going to skip a little bit of this. The term familiar spirit that you know from your missionary days in the Old Testament translates the word, the Hebrew word op, which means a ghost, a spirit summoned from the grave. And of course, that's condemned everywhere in the Old Testament. It's not something that you're looking forward to, like the Book of Mormon coming, speaking to you out of the ground. Steel and iron has been talked about an awful lot. The word steel does appear in the King James Version, and it's a mistranslation. The Hebrew words did not mean steel, because steel did not exist in the days that the term was being used. It meant copper or brass. But steel appears in the Book of Mormon, which proves that it must have existed at that time. Compass is an interesting one. This is a double linguistic anachronism because Alma is explaining to his son about the Liahona, and he tells him that this thing was a ball or a director. Our fathers called it the Liahona, which, being interpreted, is a compass. Now, of course, the compass did not exist at that time. So how could Alma be explaining to his son something by something that didn't even exist? It'd be like if in George Washington's diary he said, you know, I prophesy a day when the time will come when people will be able to sit down and type words on a keyboard, and they, instead of appearing on paper, they will appear on a screen, and, you know, just like our typewriter. And, of course, that would be a double anachronism. The windows, of course, the passage there where the brother of Jared says, well, you know, what are we going to do for light in these submarine barges that are going to take us for 344 days underwater with all the animals? That, and Arza Evans doesn't believe it. and of course, and the Lord is puzzled. He's not quite sure what he's going to do, because he thinks that the brother of Jared is asking for windows. He says, but windows would be dashed to pieces. Well, what kind of window can be dashed to pieces? It's only a window which has got glass in it. And, of course, glass windows did not exist for another 2,000 years. You can pick these out anywhere. Joseph Smith translated, loved to translate, give new translations to a number of things. He explains what the word Sabaoth means, the Hebrew word Sabaoth, which means literally the Lord of hosts. And he says, the Lord of Sabaoth, which by interpretation means the creator of the first day. He's obviously confusing Sabaoth with Sabbath, and they're completely different words. At another place, he explains in the inspired translation of the Bible, he gives us a new interpretation for the word Golgotha, which is where Jesus was crucified. It's from the Aramaic word Golgotha, meaning a skull or a place that looks like a skull. Hebrew Golgoleth, meaning the same thing. Greek word for skull is cranion. The Latin Calvaria, which is what gave the translation for Luke. But all of these writers used the Greek word, but they translated it with the Aramaic, Golgotha, and they translated they gave the Aramaic form and then translated it into Greek. But Joseph Smith says Golgotha means the place of a burial. And of course, it doesn't make sense. Nobody was buried there. Well, I'm going to skip this one. The evangelist, he also didn't know what the term evangelist mean. He made a great deal about the passage from Malachi, turning the hearts of the fathers. This is interesting because he says in Malachi and in 3rd Nephi, the passage appears exactly as it does in the English, in the King James translation. In the Joseph Smith history, he says that in describing the appearance of Moroni to him, or maybe it was Nephi, he says that he quoted it a little bit differently, and he gives the translation, the way the angel Moroni quoted the passage to him. Now here an interesting question arises. Moroni apparently didn't know his scriptures, because he disagreed with the very passage, the way it was written, in the plates that he was going to be handing to Joseph Smith. They're different. And later on, even Joseph Smith denied both of them. He says, well, it doesn't really mean that. The word turn here should be translated bind or seal. All right, well, we're going to have to... Oh, I haven't even got to the book of Abraham yet. The book of Abraham, everybody tracks the book of Abraham on the basis of the papyrus scrolls. Even if we didn't have the papyrus scrolls, we could show that it's false from the text because of the anachronisms. There are various terms used in the book of Abraham which are anachronisms. They did not exist in the day of Abraham. Pharaoh, which in the book of Abraham he says, Pharaoh is the name of an Egyptian king. Its meaning is king by royal blood, and the first Pharaoh was the great-grandson of Noah. Here are the facts. The term Pharaoh was never used as a name in Egyptian. Its meaning was great house, not king by royal blood, and it was not used even in those terms until about 1500 BC, which is several centuries after Abraham. He refers to the land of the Chaldeans. Abraham lived in the land of the Chaldeans. It was governed by Pharaoh, and their Potiphar's Hill was there, which obviously is an Egyptian name. The facts are there was no Chaldea before the 12th century BC. The first mention of Chaldeans is in the 9th century BC. The Chaldean dynasty did not even come into existence until the 8th century BC, and Egypt never ruled Mesopotamia. We have the term Aegyptus, who was, according to the book of Abraham, was the wife of Ham, mother of Pharaoh, and it is a Chaldean word meaning forbidden. And it's obviously intended to be the source of the name Egypt, the name of the country. Here are the facts. Egypt is a Greek word, not an Egyptian word. It's Aegyptos. It's from the Egyptian term Hatkapta, which was the Egyptian name for the city of Memphis. The Hebrew name for Egypt was Mizraim. I'm going to skip this. These are a little bit, okay? The Tower of Babel, of course, you have to believe in the Tower of Babel if you believe in the Book of Mormon, because that's where the Jaredites came from. No linguistic scholar gives any credence to the Tower of Babel. It's an ideological myth. Here's an odd one, because Hebrew names occur in the Book of Ether. The Jaredites, of course, did not speak Hebrew. They left the Tower of Babel before the languages were confounded, and the Hebrew language did not exist. And yet here you've got three Hebrew names in the Book of Ether. How did they get there? Okay. We have to talk about, for just a moment, engraving on plates. And we can go through this real fast. The reason that they were engraved on plates was because they couldn't write much because the plates were small. Okay? Now think about how these plates were produced by Nephi and Moroni, or Moron and Mormon, and that was not intentional. These guys are sitting there with a stylus of some kind, scratching out character by character on metal. That's where he talks about it. Could there have developed something like Reformed Egyptian? Yes, of course there could. Yeah. Languages change over the course of decades and centuries, and so there could have been an alternate version of Egyptian. However, not all of the Book of Mormon was written in Reformed Egyptian. Do you realize that? Only the part that was abridged by Mormon was written in Reformed Egyptian. The part that Nephi wrote, the plates of Nephi, were simply found by Mormon. They were written in Egyptian, and he attached them. So that's a quiz question for you. Okay? Yeah. I think it's in Mosiah. Yeah, okay. Here's an example of Egyptian hieroglyphics. Above, those are the hieroglyphic characters, the little pictures, and those characters mean, I have given bread, and they were probably pronounced something like, Au er tana tau. If that were written in Hebrew characters, or if it were written in Hebrew, the Hebrew way of saying that would be, Natali lehem. And it would take those seven characters, is it? If you were to be translating, if you were to be writing Egypt, the Egyptian sound in Hebrew characters, it would look something like the characters below, which I've used English characters instead of Hebrew characters. Here's examples of Egyptian demotic script and Hebrew script. Remember, they wrote in Egyptian because the Hebrew would have taken up too much room. There are 22 characters in the Hebrew alphabet. Some have slightly differing forms. Demotic, Egyptian demotic script was also an alphabetic thing. They didn't need to use Egyptian. They could have used Hebrew easily. Here are the characters of the Anton transcript. Notice, too, that no divinely inspired translator has been able, among the Mormon prophets, has been able to tell us what those characters say. we're supposed to stop. I'm already 10 minutes over. So let's stop. Okay. Well, okay. Yeah, you're sure you don't mind? Huh? Okay. I'm back to Washington's diary. Here's an inscription on a pocket watch presented to George Washington to his wife. To my dearest and most precious wife, and I present this. I won't read the whole thing, but there it is. Now, ask yourself, would this have been engraved on a pocket watch to fit in the house? We see all kinds of signs in the, if you read the Book of Mormon, with it, keeping in mind, this was engraved character by character on metal. Okay? Would this kind of thing occur? There are dozens and dozens of examples of editing on the go in the Book of Mormon, where, for example, he says, wherefore I, Nephi, did make a record upon these other plates, which give an account, or which gives a greater account of the wars. Do you think that he would have done that engraving? Or the next one. Even the very God of Israel do men trample under their feet. I say trample under their feet, but I would speak, in other words, they set him at naught. I call this editing on the go. Next time you read the Book of Mormon, as you are supposed to do, watch for these, editing on the go. You can find a lot of them simply by searching for the phrase, or in other words, here's an example, the wordiness. Here's an example of, on the left is a wordy passage. On the right is what I would have written if I had been having to do it on plates. Okay? And again, there are hundreds of examples of this. There's one, here's more wordiness. The original on the left, this on the right. This one is beautiful, you know. Jaredites were just as wordy, tight like unto a dish. Still more wordiness. Okay. Commencement. This was a favorite word of Joseph Smith's. Unnecessary repetition. All through the Book of Mormon. Well, this one from 3rd Nephi. I mean, even Jesus was repetitious. He says, I bear record of the Father bears record of me, the Holy Ghost will bear record of me and the Father, and so on. Bearing record all over the place. Now, in all honesty, I have to take a few minutes and point out some criticisms that have been made on a linguistic basis that I do not think are valid or very strong at any rate. One is the Reformed Egyptian. The first kind of objection is there was no such language. Well, you know, there are all kinds of ancient languages are being discovered all the time, and there's no reason why there shouldn't be a have been a Reformed Egyptian. The "and it came to pass" thing. This is a favorite, people making fun of the Book of Mormon. They don't seem to realize that it also occurs frequently in the King James Bible. I counted at least 600 times. And there's no reason to object to that. And by the way, in the Old Testament, it's not only the phrase, "and it came to pass," in the Old Testament, but the same Hebrew term is translated in other ways, such as, "and it then happened," or "what then occurred was," or something like that. To show you what it would have looked like in Hebrew are these characters, woyahi. And, gee, you know, as a shorthand term, you know, da-da-da-da, it's a way of saying then, and so, all right. It's not good English style, but it certainly was not necessarily poor Hebrew style. Also, the fact that he said adieu in Jacob, I don't find that. Some people have objected the passage where in 2 Nephi he goes to the cold and silent grave whence no traveler can return as being a quote from Hamlet's soliloquy, "To be or not to be," but it also occurs in the Book of Job. Or the objection where it's prophesied that Christ would be born in Jerusalem, the land of our fathers, born at Jerusalem in the land of our fathers. We do that all the time, you know. I mean, I say I'm from Roseburg. I'm not from Roseburg. I'm from Dixonville, which is 5 miles outside of Roseburg. And Bethlehem is 6 miles outside of Jerusalem. Now, there are evidences offered, linguistic evidences offered for word print studies. We can toss that off quickly. Not even the scholars at Farms, all scholars at Farms, buy into the word print studies. John Tretinus doesn't buy it, for example. The chiasm or chiasmus, that's also something that occurs very frequently in all kinds of texts, including Joseph Smith's letters, John Taylor's letters. Similarities between names, we'll skip that. The name Nahum and the Lehiites as being derived from the Book of Mormon, from so on. You know, they found a place in Arabia on the coast named Nahum, and they found a tribe of Arabian natives that changed their name about 600 B.C., to what it was, to Lehiites. Okay, this kind of thing is, and I'm going to give you one more. This is an article by L. Dwayne Samuelson, Lehi and Pacific, in which he points out other linguistic evidence for the journey of Lehi across the Pacific. For example, he claims to be able to trace their journey from Arabia to the Andaman Islands, which are obviously named after Adam Andai Aman. They landed on the island of Sumatra, which is named after Sam, one of his sons, and the Greek and the Hebrew word Atar, meaning entreat, which is obviously the place where Sam entreated his brothers not to be evil to Java. It's, of course, the name of God, Jehovah, and so on and so on. Especially impressive is Timor, which is the Greek word Timora, meaning palm tree, which is where the palm trees were. Well, let's see. And there's even one, the island of Niafu'u, named after Nephi. And, of course, the one I like that I think is most persuasive is Bora Bora, which is two Hebrew words which appear similar, but they are different. They have different meanings, meaning clean and water. they obviously stopped there for water. And you can also trace Mulek across the northern part of the Pacific. And the most significant ones are when he lands, they landed in Hawaii, which is, of course, just derived from Yehawa and Oahu, Jehovah, you know, and the mountain names, you know. Mauna Loa is from Maun, meaning dwelling place, and Loa, Hebrew, Eloi, meaning God, okay? I have a special treat for you today. I'd like you to meet the author of this article to take your questions. I wrote it. It's a bunch of bunk. I wrote it by taking a map of the Pacific Ocean, opening up a Hebrew dictionary, and I found all those places with Hebrew names. So, all right. We have to conclude that Joseph, or his divine inspiration, had no knowledge of Greek or Hebrew, no understanding of Egyptian, there was no text engraved on any plates, at least that we have a translation for, no knowledge of ancient history, and no knowledge of the history of languages. Thanks for your attention.